And we're back. Welcome back to Deep Thinking, the motorcycle road racing podcast. The first, the only, everything else is just an illusion.
Number 28.
I am Michael Gugis, and you can read whatever it is that I have to think about or say that weekend or that day or that moment at motorbikeroadracing.blogspot.com. And Ed Sorbo of Lindemann Engineering, who is working, dropping a shock of mine even as we speak.
I dropped it in the solvent tank. That's why it made so much noise.
Yeah.
It's greasy and slippery with grime.
Oh, yeah. There's clean. There's operating room clean. And then there's Ed clean. Ed, where can we find you on the web?
le-suspension.com. Or you can do a Google search for Lindemann Engineering.
That's le-suspension.com. Ed, did I tell you about the Brian Short's bike burning?
You did.
Oh, that poor guy.
I
feel really bad. Because, you rarely see a bike burn for that long, you know? And looking back, I saw the crash. I was at the We're a West event at Las Vegas Motor Speedway yesterday. And I saw Brian crash. And the bike starts tumbling. And I saw this like haze of blue stuff, this light blue stuff, as the bike is coming through the air, flying through the air. And I thought, I wonder what that is. I thought it was tire smoke. But of course, now I realize that the tank had been holed at that point, And
the first time I saw a bike on fire,
It
was at right after a WIRA 24-hour West at Willow Springs. So talk about freaking crazy, right?
Oh.
On Saturday at noon, you start a 24-hour race.
Right.
On Sunday at noon, it ends.
Right.
And then, on Sunday at, 1:30 or something, they had Suzuki Cup money GSXR races.
Sprint races.
And so Doug Polin was in a race with somebody, and I don't know whose bike it was. I don't think it was Doug.
Mm-hmm.
But the bike, he crashed coming out of Turn 6 at Big Willow, and the bike slid down through Turn 7 and on the way to Turn 8 with a wall of fire chasing it, like in Roadrunner cartoons.
Man.
Fortunately, the gas started sloshing.
Right.
So there were gaps in the fire. So when the bike came to a stop, the fire didn't make it to the bike.
Man.
So then, of course, the fire cleaned itself up.
Yeah, nicely, right? By the way, if you want to see a picture of that, it's at my new photo site. It's motorbikeroadracing.smugmug.com.
How do you come up with these names?
Smugmug is a great tool for amateur photographers.
Oh, Smugmug is an existing...
Yeah.
How did they come up with that name?
I have no idea, but it's just it took me all of 30 minutes to set the site up.
So why are we making these noises in the background?
Wait a minute. We're not done with burning motorcycles yet. So I was talking to Sean and Evelyn, and they told me two things from endurance racing. Number one, I think it was Virginia Breeze Racing, who used to routinely light their bikes on fire during crashes. That's the reason that they, I don't know if they have it in the rule book, but they strongly recommend dead man switches for endurance bikes. Because it was around the time that Virginia Breeze was racing with them that the Yamaha FZR 1000 was introduced with an electric fuel pump. And when that would crash and the fuel system would be breached, as long as the battery was still on, the fuel was still pumping. And so that took a long time to get out. But my other one was they had and I can't remember whose bike it was, crash and caught on fire and landed in a hay bale, which then immediately caught on fire. And the best they could do was start pulling the other hay bales away from the burning mess, because they couldn't do anything about the hay bale. They had to wait for the local fire department to show up and put the bike out. And the bike was delivered back to the poor team in the front of a skip loader, because there was no way of moving it otherwise. That was awful.
So there are lots of fire stories. The best one for Hawaii Raceway Park was the day that we had fire, flood, and pestilence in one day. So
plague of locusts?
The pestilence was a beehive that was near the racetrack.
Right.
The flood was... The women's bathroom was flooded in the morning.
Okay.
And the fire actually had another flood as well. Sparks from a bike caught the brush on fire on the uphill side of turn two.
Wow.
And we got the fire put out, but not before there was enough smoke you know, because you don't expect the fire over there. It's not like we have an extinguisher right next
right,
to it, right?
Right, right.
So there was enough smoke. Somebody in, you know, called the fire department. And then those guys got there and were like, yeah, yeah, don't worry. The fire's out. But they're there. They got to do their thing. So they got to spray water on the smoldering grass, which is uphill from the racetrack. So now we have fucking mud on the racetrack. Get out of here.
All that's missing was frogs.
But
and Moses.
Let's back up a little bit. Virginia Breeze.
Yeah, yeah.
Team Hawaii was racing when they were racing. I don't remember any of their bikes catching on fire.
Are you saying that Sean Clark's memories?
I'm saying that between him and you and everybody involved, that the story got a little twisted. There was never a dead man's switch rule.
No, it's not a rule. It's recommendation.
Never, no.
That's what I'm told.
Show me anybody who has a motorcycle with a dead man switch on it.
That's what they... Are you telling me that Sean Clark from Wira,
yeah,
might not be telling me the truth?
I'm are you saying telling he's you that because you know, I don't might have been talking about A and you were thinking about B. I don't know.
I don't think... You know what? I don't think Sean would argue if we said that he was confused.
Drag bikes have dead man switches.
Right, right.
So people know a dead man switch is like what you have on a jet ski. So that when...
Right.
Actually, no, jet skis don't have that. Jet skis just slow down and go in circles.
Right.
A dead man switch would be a cord that when you fall off the bike, it pulls something and the engine cutoff switch is...
It's like on your treadmill. You're supposed to
have that so you don't do... That would ruin all those funny videos of people flying into walls.
Yeah.
So anyway, what we're doing right now is we previously changed the springs and...
Previously on LA Law.
And the valving in the forks in Gouges's, what the hell is this thing?
Bandit 1200.
Yeah, and so that made it all way better. And then, of course, now he notices that the back's not so good because the balance is, right? The front's good, now the back's bad. Interestingly, balance is so important to motorcycle setup that you're better off to have the bike equally fucked up, front and rear, than to have one end good and the other end still fucked up. That's worse than having them both messed up because the balance gets thrown off and the bike is all unpredictable then. So if you have a problem with your bike, the same problem front and rear, right, your springs aren't strong enough or you have too much preload or whatever, if you got it the same in both ends, whatever the bike does that you don't like, it will do it in every single corner every single time.
Right. And you can adapt.
Well, it's predictable. You can change your speed and you can avoid crashing. But if you have, let's say, a too strong of a spring in the front and a too weak of a spring in the rear or any other combination like that, it won't do the same thing every time. Sometimes in corner one, it'll do X. And the next lap, it'll do Y.
Uh-huh.
And then that really messes you up, right? It becomes unpredictable. And then it makes you think that it's you screwing up and it ruins your confidence. So that's all bad. So now we want to get Michael's butt to match his hands.
Let's go with that. That's a nice way of phrasing it.
So, by the way, what we have here...
I have a brief aside.
Imagine that.
Oh, no! Are we actually going to have a conversational diversion? Yes, yes, we are. I had a book, Nighttime Reader, History of the Formula One Car, 1945 to 1990. The designer for Arrows, one year, they had some problem where they had a very short period of time to design the car, and they could not, he didn't have time to do everything that he wanted to do with the rear grip and the sliding skirts or something like that. I think it was a sliding skirt period. I do remember him, his quote was, "I decided to deliberately just destroy the grip at the rear of the car. There was no reason, I couldn't get it to work at its maximum, so I just came up with something that wouldn't work. The front and rear suddenly became balanced, and the car was a rocket ship the next year."
Well, that balance thing is important. Kevin Schwantz struggled with the Suzuki for all those years.
Yeah.
At one event, the bike would work, and at a different event, the bike wouldn't work, a different track and whatever. And the issue was balance, always. So, Michael, Jesus.
I blame Suzuki.
Don't go near your motorcycles with tools.
I haven't touched it.
I need my workspace.
Oh, you need your workspace
and follow the recorder. Me around with the recorder.
I haven't touched this. This is stock, and I suspect it's
stock. It's not stock. Somebody changed it.
Really?
What it has is it has the preload maxed out.
Wow.
And it's so much preload that I don't have a long enough
hooky little lever thing to make it turn to loosen the preload.
So you can't get enough leverage on it.
So I'm going to, and I, this is a common problem, you know.
Is it?
So, yeah. And okay. So I'm going to just remove the spring and then adjust the preloader afterwards.
Hey,
so
when
you have a weak spring...
Wait a minute, weren't we just talking about fulcrums and leverage and shit like that?
Michael liked how I got the shock out of his bike. I needed to... I have the bike up on the center stand, and I loosen up the nuts that hold the bolts for holding the shock mount top and bottom, and the weight of the wheel and the swing arm is pressing down on the bolts, so I can't push them out easily. So I got a bar, and I put the end of the bar on the opposite side of the rear wheel from me, and lifted on the bar on my end, thus a lever and a fulcrum, lifting the weight of the rear wheel so I could push the bolts out easily, avoiding the problem of having to strain to pick up the rear wheel because the bike's on the table and I'd be bending at the waist and, you know, all that stuff hurting my back.
By the way, another brief aside.
Better to work smart than hard.
Yes, and another brief aside, center stands need to come back on street bikes. No,
yeah, aren't center stands nice?
Oh my God.
You know what made center stands go away? Sport bikes wanting to be light.
Lighter.
But the other big thing was poorly designed center stands and people not understanding how to use them.
Right.
So that center stands are a freaking miserable pain in the ass. But if you get one that they did a little bit of engineering and they got a decent amount of leverage, and you know, you read the owner's manual
and they tuck up out of the way,
figure out, okay, if I stand like this and I push down, oh, and look, there's a nice handle here, and then you do it the right way, you step down while lifting up and back, it's easy.
Yep.
You know, and you'll notice all the big touring bikes like the Goldwings, right? Those things weigh a ton and
right.
It's easy to put them on the center stand.
Absolutely.
So anyway,
you know what else made them go away? Back when you would buy 4-into-1 for a bike like this?
So this bike had so much spring on the preload that when I took the spacer out with my spring compression tool and I backed off the jack all the way, there was still preload pushing on the spring such that I can't get the shock out of here. I've got to reset my starting point.
Jeez.
So
that would be why it was so bouncy.
Yes,
okay.
Exactly, which is very good. So Michael noticed that the back of the bike was all boingy after we improved the front of the bike.
Because we like to use those technical terms.
And then, so he called me and talking to me on the phone. I go, okay, well, lift up the back of the bike when the wheels are on the ground and tell me what it does. He goes, as soon as I lift it, it's lifting the whole bike. There's no free sag.
Right.
That's how you know you have too much preload, or actually way too much preload. You want a little bit of free sag all the time. Better to have a weak spring with the correct amount of preload than to have a weak spring with too much preload. Too much preload is bad, bad, bad. A weak spring is just bad. Okay.
What are we doing?
I put a tool away.
Oh, you put a tool away.
Well, okay. I'm nervous because you're wandering around doing stuff, and you're
that can't be good.
Keeps ending up. As a matter of fact, Eric Anderson is racing at Vegas with Wira right now.
Right.
And he has my 22 millimeter socket.
Is he the one?
Because he put it in his toolbox when we were at Willow a couple weeks ago. And he hasn't sent it back to me yet.
You know what? Eric had a tool of mine for a while.
Yeah, well, you had one of my tools, too.
No, I don't have that tool.
So.
Okay, so we got the spring off.
We got the spring off, and let's say you're riding a motorcycle that has a weak spring.
Got it.
Okay? That means you go over a bump or around the corner, and the suspension's going to compress more than optimal.
Right.
And we don't want that to happen because when the suspension compresses...
And it's more than optimal.
The suspension moves slower the farther down in the stroke it goes.
So that's why it feels like you have a too soft
spring.
So
then it makes it feel like the ride's too harsh.
Really
harsh. Oh, my spring's too strong. No, you're in the wrong part of the travel.
Got it. Okay.
So when you put a lot of preload onto a spring,
right,
you don't make the spring any stronger, as you know if you listen to our previous podcast where we talked about springs.
Right.
You just store a lot of energy in the spring, which makes the bike jump up after the bumps in the corner. So now instead of having one problem, you got two problems. So you made your situation worse by giving yourself more preload.
I haven't touched it. I want to be very clear about that. I want
you made your
record.
Situation worse.
I didn't
by
touch
not
it.
Paying attention to how much preload was on
and
your shock.
You know what? I was too busy going wee.
And now
when I put turn the throttle on this thing.
Now we're gonna clean the shock some more, get the springs out of the way. And so what we're doing, what I would normally do for a customer,
right,
is I would fix everything. The spring rate and the valving in one go.
Right, but we're not doing that this time.
We're not doing it for customer.
Right, we're doing it.
And it's actually kind of better science to do just the spring.
One change at a time.
And then Michael's going to learn what the spring did for him.
Right.
And then at some future time, we'll worry about the valving. We might decide, you know what, the valving's good enough for street riding. And
yeah.
The spring made it so, so much better that I'm fine with that.
It's a possibility. This is a
That's what I do with all the BMW shocks.
Yeah, and this one's a freeway sled. Right? This bike is never going to be on a racetrack.
Yeah.
It's designed to get me from home to work, 51.8 miles away each way.
Your $15 a day rental car gets you from point A to point B just fine, and the radio works good. You don't need fancy suspension to ride on the street.
I will put in another plug for a Suzuki Bandit 1200. It's so much fun. You're rolling at about 90, stop gearing, you know, and the speedo's reading at about 90. On this bike with the 4-into-1 and the jet kit, that's right at the bottom of the power band, so to speak. So it's just no downshift, no none of that nonsense. It's just blip, vroom, and you know, it's a lot of smiles. Everybody needs a bike like this. Uh-oh, Ed is staring carefully at the bottom of the shock. This is not a good sign.
That's just because my eyesight's not good enough to read the little numbers.
What are we looking for? Oh, that's
what
right. This one's got damping.
See, it's a bad sign when you don't even know what your stock bike has.
Why would I know?
How many of our listeners do you think have cats?
Probably a lot.
Yeah, so they would have the cat experience, and everybody knows what that is. When you are walking somewhere and the cat is between you and there, the cat has a magical ability to try to get out of your way by going in the direction of whatever thing you're going to.
Right.
So if you're walking towards the refrigerator in the kitchen, the cat walks towards the refrigerator.
Right.
I just want my listeners to know that Michael Gouges is a freaking cat when I'm trying to work on something in my shop.
Have I told you about my theory about being a lion?
Okay, no. And I want to see you incorporate the circle of life into this.
No, I don't need a circle of life. All I'm saying is that if I were a male lion, okay, basically a male lion's job, right, is to sleep 20 hours a day, have
and
sex with multiple
females. The food that the women find.
No, the females bring him the food, okay, while, you know, to make sure he has the strength to have sex with multiple women. Right? His basic job is to fight off other male lions. The first thing I would do is have a little meeting with all the other male lions and go, look, dudes, we have got this good. We sleep 20 hours a day. People bring us food. All we have to do is defend ourselves against each other, right? So look, let's talk. Every now and then, we stage a little fight out in the middle of the savannah. We roll around. There's lots of growling. No reason for us to actually argue, right? We all go home, maybe a little battered up, get a little sympathy from our pride, have a little meal, have a little, you know, and then go back to sleep for another 20 hours. Who's got it better than that?
Well, there's the part of starving to death and...
Well, you don't need to starve to death. No, we cooperate. Ed, this is the point. There's no reason to argue over resources that we perceive to be scarce if they're not really scarce. That's all I'm saying. Okay, now back to your regularly scheduled programming. What are we
How are we doing on time?
We got, I think, 2 minutes left. Where are we at? We're at 19:07. So what's the spring rate on this bad boy?
I'm going to know momentarily.
We're actually measuring the stock spring rate. This shock is also adjustable, but for some reason, the adjustment is in the place where it'd be damn near impossible.
The adjustment is in the normal spot where it always is
on
the bottom of the shock.
Nah, you can't read
that. And it's a damping adjuster.
It's a damping adjuster.
Which means it gives you more or less compression and rebound together.
Of everything.
Screw the thing in or out.
So where did you put it at? Where did you set this at?
I haven't set it yet.
Oh, okay.
I was just moving it around and testing it to make sure it was functioning.
Does it function?
The shock is in great shape. It
really?
It does not need to be rebuilt.
Wow. Okay.
So the spring rate of this spring is 560 pounds per inch.
560 pounds per inch on the stock. And that's way too soft for this?
Way too weak.
Way too
How
weak.
How many times do I have to give you the correct terminology? Yes. So now I'm going to do my formula and figure out the correct spring for Michael's weight for this motorcycle and install it with the correct amount of preload. And that will eliminate the boingy boingy. And at some point, Michael will report what a genius I am.
You will have to tune into a future episode
of Deep Thinking.
Deep Thinking, the motorcycle road racing podcast. He's Ed Sorbo. I'm Michael Gugis, and aloha.